A final note to bosses. There's a fair amount of hubris involved in writing a book about the future of anything. This is doubly true for work, which is a vague term that doesn't begin to adequately describe the universe of industries, jobs, expectations, injustices, and strategies that make up our collective laboring. We are attempting to peer around a corner and offer potential visions of what's to come. It's not lost on us that this is treacherous territory. As Scott Birkin, who wrote the best-selling book on remote work all the way back in 2013, points out, books about the future of work make the same mistake. They fail to look back at the history of work, or, more precisely, the history of books about the future of work, and how wrong they were. Having read our fair share of those books in preparation for this one, we agree, which is why we've tried not to offer predictions, and focus instead on mapping out the potential for a lasting paradigm shift. If there is an underlying mood running through this book, it is a feeling of hopeful caution. We believe that work is occupying more and more of our time, burning us out, conferring few of the spoils on workers. We also believe that the pandemic has created a rare pause for reflection and an opportunity to rethink the status quo. Still, we're realists. We understand that the past is full of ponderous future of work predictions that feel like hubristic attempts to solve serious problems at scale. Ultimately, these solves leave a trail of new, even thornier problems in their wake. Which is why, behind every suggestion or example in this book, there's a nagging note of caution. Cut corners and risk repeating the mistakes of the past. In other words, don't screw this up. If you're a manager or executive listening to those words, you might be rolling your eyes. You shouldn't. While much of what we've laid out here is firmly rooted in making workers' lives better for workers, reimagining how we work isn't merely some altruistic project. If you run a company, there are many reasons you don't want to screw this up, but chief among them is that a remote future is better business. You might remember Darren Murph, GitLab's head of remote, from a previous chapter. Murph is one of the first, if not the first person, whose job is dedicated exclusively to remote work strategy. Since March 2020, his expertise has been in high demand, and he spends his days in and out of meetings with big companies, all trying to wrap their heads around the ways in which their businesses will change when the pandemic subsides. In many of the meetings, he told us, executives are stubborn or dubious about fully remote work. And so he puts it in terms they can understand, specifically, compounding interest. Murph likes to ask these executives a simple question. If they had the choice, would they rather have invested in Warren Buffett's holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, 20 minutes ago or 20 years ago? The choice, of course, is obvious. There are a few investment choices you can make in the present that would make up for the compounding interest lost when you chickened out on an investment opportunity. And this is how Murph frames GitLab's investment in a fully asynchronous, distributed workforce. Setting up GitLab's workflows to thrive with no office and with employees scattered across every time zone was not easy. It required substantial upfront investment of time and energy and resources. And to the naked eye, the company's exhaustive open source documentation process, every meeting, every employee readme, every wiki and strategic plan, might look unnecessary and inefficient. But that line of thinking, Murph argues, is dangerously short-term. Our corporate norms condition us to put one foot in front of the other, Murph told us. Everyone is thinking about their jobs in 30-minute chunks, meeting by meeting, email by email. We are so focused on getting through the day, he argues, that our idea of working efficiently is actually deeply inefficient. His company's documentation strategy is an example of the way forward. GitLab's employees spend less time intruding on others in the middle of the day or sending redundant emails because all the information they need, whether they attended a meeting or not, is recorded and easily accessible to all. If I ask you to take 20 minutes before a meeting to read my README, that's a short-term sacrifice that will pay dividends over time as our working relationship deepens over the weeks and months and years, he said. We have built up an 8,000-page, easily searchable library from employees documenting their successes and failures. That's 8,000 pages of what not to do. How will you catch up to the compound interest of that? The only way is for companies to start that knowledge journey now. Otherwise, their competitors will, and every year their competitive advantage will increase. Stop thinking short-term. This isn't just Murph's advice. It is the recurring theme in our hundreds of conversations with executives, management coaches, urbanists, activists, technologists, and workers. In our reporting, most managerial horror stories can be traced back to a set of hasty decisions made in the convenience of the moment without stepping back to imagine the broader implications. Understaffing, for example, might be cheaper in the short term, but it slowly begins to eat away at a company. Morale sinks, productivity and quality drain, and employers struggle to retain workers. A company that burns its workers out quickly can hide turnover issues in a competitive industry, but only for so long. The trends emerge on workplace review sites like Glassdoor. What started as disgruntled whispers at the end of the workday at the bar becomes a solidified reputation. Recruiting high-quality candidates gets harder and harder. You know this. You know not investing in management training leads to miserable workers, and that unhappy workers are more expensive workers. You know that relentless focus on short-term metrics like growth and shareholder value irreparably damages the way workers think about and trust their employers. You know that papering over the decreased benefits and pensions with bromides about company culture or ornamental perks engenders good faith loyalty only in the short term, if at all. And you know the short and shallow efforts to employ quick technological fixes to increase productivity don't work well in the long term either. You know that employees who are overwhelmed with what Greylock venture capitalist Sarah Guo calls meta-work, endlessly tabbing between programs, projects, and constantly navigating or quieting digital distractions. In his book, A World Without Email, the author Cal Newport describes this as having to work alongside a hyperactive hive mind. Or, as he puts it, a workflow centered around ongoing conversation, fueled by unstructured and unscheduled messages. Newport argues that this is deeply ineffective and requires that you frequently switch your attention from your work to talking about work and then back again. Again, you know all this. But for various reasons, you've become very good at quieting or ignoring that knowledge. But now is the time to act otherwise. The diminishing returns of overwork are real. Aggregate gains in productivity are happening at less than 40% the speed of the previous two decades. That figure is so stark because of just how much more we're working. Between 1980 and 2000, the average American added an extra 164 hours of work in the course of a year. We are all burning out, including you. Even when job satisfaction is high, we're quitting our jobs at higher rates than ever before and moving on to the next spot. And our early attempts at remote work have largely reproduced that culture inside our living rooms. In the early months of the pandemic, Americans spent more than 22 million extra hours working each workday. You know this. And here's what we know. Workers are desperate for more autonomy over their lives. They crave more balance and less precarity. They also crucially want to work. But they want to work for places that treat them as human beings and then invest in them in their futures. They want to be a part of organizations that recognize that meaningful and collaborative work can bring dignity and create value, but that work is by no means the only way to cultivate satisfaction and self-worth. We know that workers who are overextended become too tired, frustrated, and anxious to do their best work. They're too busy trying to tread water, look busy, and keep poorly communicating bosses happy. We know this because they've told us. Hundreds of them. There is so much overlap between what workers want and what is actually best for a company in the long run. You could call this synergy, or you could call it what it really is, common sense. But if we are actually going to have any chance at reimagining the way we do knowledge work, you, as managers and executives, have to be on board. Most executives, Darren Murph says, drastically underestimate the power of signaling from leaders. If companies reopen their offices when it's safe for all, executives, perhaps counterintuitively, shouldn't be the first ones in the door. They should be the last. As soon as a CEO goes back full time, it sends a signal to everyone in the company that if I want to progress, I need to be there with them to rub shoulders, Murph said. Leadership has to model the posture it encourages their workforce to adopt. Full stop. But leaders also chronically underestimate the amount of intentional planning and actual time it will take for the true benefits of these shifts to materialize. Remote or flexible work isn't a line item to add to your chief people officer's job description, Murph argues. It is a full-time job that requires a leader and dedicated team members to handle the re-architecturing of policies, workflows, and perks. For a comparison, Murph suggests leaders to look at the trajectory of the chief diversity officer in many tech companies. What started as a boutique HR initiative was actually a wave of change cascading through not just tech, but companies of all sizes. It seems obvious now to hire a chief diversity officer, even though it really should have been obvious then, Murph said. But companies refuse to see the obvious. Nobody can see the future. We can, however, get a sense of what might seem obvious tomorrow, but only if we stop obsessing over short-term gains. When Murph gets frustrated, he recounts an anecdote about Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos that's become his remote work parable. A few years back, Amazon announced that it had posted record profits on its quarterly earnings call. An analyst on the call spoke directly to Bezos, offering his congratulations on a spectacular quarter. Bezos thanked him and moved on, but in his head, he was thinking something else. The guy didn't get it. What Bezos was really thinking was, that quarter was baked 3 years ago. This, Murph says, is what he's talking about when he talks about remote infrastructure and compounding interest. I keep telling companies, don't expect savings right away. If you own real estate and have 10 or 20 year leases, it won't happen quickly, he said. Short-term thinkers will see these leases as a reason not to change their policies. But what happens when the lease expires? They'll look around and they'll see their competitors, Murph said. And those competitors invested early in a remote-first approach, and now they're able to easily adapt to whatever's next. Meanwhile, that company will be flat-footed. Many leaders won't listen, especially in entrenched industries like finance. In early 2021, Goldman Sachs CEO called remote work an aberration that we are going to correct as quickly as possible. But as the office trend analyst Dror Pollaig notes, they'll be doing so at their own peril. Forcing everyone to work in a certain way seems dated in a world where talented employees have more choice than ever. Every year, more and more graduates are opting for more flexible industries over those that remain stubbornly inflexible. Between 2008 and 2018, big tech went from hiring 12% of business school grads to 17%. In finance, the percentage dropped from 20 to 13%. And that was before the pandemic. If financial firms don't get on board with flexible work, Pollaig predicts, that shift towards tech will only continue. This principle applies far beyond the world of finance. Executives have had flex forever, Michael Colasino, the head of the commercial real estate firm Squarefoot, told us. I've been able to work from home on Friday since 1992. People always say that the future is here, it just hasn't been evenly distributed. And that's true. Flexibility has just been segregated off into the C-suite and slightly downstream. So what you have happening now is that no one's going to accept the 5 days in the office mentality. Now that they've tasted the forbidden fruit, there's no going back. If you say to a millennial, come back 9 to 5, 5 days a week, people are just going to quit. Finance execs know they should be figuring out new ways to work, but those who rose through the ranks one way and endured a particular form of suffering and overwork are reluctant to change their ways, no matter how much evidence is presented of the benefits of abandoning them. It's irrational. It's bad business practice, but after months of fear and instability, it feels safe. But that sort of comfort will prove fleeting, because if history is any guide, the business case for remote work will be made by the same high-paid consultants and pundits who sneered at it as soon as the societal pressure for flexible work reaches a tipping point. And this makes sense. What remote work ultimately does is nudge companies to do the things that they know they should be doing anyway. And if you take anything away from this book, maybe it should be that. None of this is really about anything new. It's about what you already knew. We get it if this all sounds a bit credulous, that Murph's evangelism or the general arguments in this book treat working from home like it's some magical cure-all. It's not. In fact, most of the ideas in this book, including the plea to apply a long-term lens to how businesses are run, aren't really about the nitty-gritty of remote work. They're about opening your eyes to better ways of working. The whole post-pandemic, when and how we will return to the office debate is in some ways just a big distraction. The true issue at hand is not where we will work, but how we will work. Remote work forces you to change the how. It is not a cure for shitty management or a bad business model or a bad product. It is merely an organizing principle. Being removed from the luxury of tapping anyone on the shoulder at their desk or bumping into somebody in the elevator means thinking more intentionally about how you work. Stripping out some of the artifice and vestigial norms of the office gives us the chance to see our companies as what they really are and what they've always been, a collection of human beings. If you are a leader in your organization, then you already know this. But now is a time for leadership and a time to act. It is a time and opportunity to imagine what might seem obvious tomorrow and to lay the groundwork for that future today. It's an investment, yes, and investments always bring risk. But hopefully, we've given you an idea of the compounding interest to come. Go forth, and don't screw it up.